Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode. This is going to be part two of Osama bin Laden. We're gonna get right into it. Again, sources, we got Ghost Wars by Steve Cole, very good, and The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright, also very good. I would read Ghost Wars if you had to read one, but The Looming Tower, I did like it because it was different. It was more like focused directly on Osama bin Laden, so if you're looking for his story, there's also an Osama bin Laden book. It was released recently, and I have not read it. I figured I was all Osama'd out, you know.
Yeah.
By the time I got through these two, I was like, all right, I think I get it, you know.
Yeah. Like, what's you're like, I don't even want to hear about the 2000s anymore.
Nah, I'm good, man. Yeah, I'm good. I've been reading ancient history. I'm just like, let me get as far away.
Oh, you went ancient? No, yeah.
I went way back. I was like, oh god, this is rough. Anyway, we're getting into it. Part two. Act 1, Premonitions. So,
I love your names. But
on February 23rd of 1933, Ramzi Youssef bombs the World Trade Center. He sets off a car bomb, specifically a red Chevy Corsica, in the garage below the World Trade Center, and it kills 6 people who were eating lunch in the cafeteria. It injures 1,000. We learned later, as in like Americans learned later, that he had the goal, upon like his interrogation, he had the goal of causing one tower to fall into the other. And he said whenever he was extradited and, you know, the FBI was interviewing him, he said he had the goal, or he said that he wanted to kill 250,000 people. Because that was, and this is where these two sources conflict, that was either equal to the amount of Palestinians that had been killed by Israel or the amount of people that had been killed in the Hiroshima bombings. So they kind of differ on that. Youssef, for his part, he gets a ticket to Karachi in Pakistan, and then he ends up in Manila. He gets back to Pakistan, and I believe that's where he's extradited from. But like before he departs, he gives a letter of demands to like New York newspapers, where he calls for an end to all aid to Israel, and he wants the U.S. to cut diplomatic ties with Israel also, and also just generally stay out of the Middle East, like withdraw, let us handle our own affairs. Get your big nose out of our region, you know.
The 250,000, like either being Palestine or Palestinians or Hiroshima, it's interesting because like one of them like displays them. It's like, I'm an international guy. I care about everybody.
Yeah.
And then the other one also. I mean, it's interesting because with Ramzi Youssef, you always hear about that as like that first attack on the World Trade Center,
mm-hmm.
which you kind of I've always had assumed that it was like also Al Qaeda.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's more, from what you're telling me here, more mm-hmm. uh, more of a, just a guy just doing his own freelance terrorism.
Yeah, parallel thinking, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like OBL was a hack, you know? He just ripped it off already, right? Anyway, some background on Ramzi Youssef. His mother, he was like Palestinian through his mother's side, and he was trained at a CIA-supplied madrasas. He was like a tinkerer, like an engineer. Yeah. And so, you know, Steve Cole in Ghost Wars says that a lot of like the plastic and plastic explosives and delayed time devices that ended up at these madrasas. He posits that Youssef might have been fiddling with those. The name of the specific camp is called Caldan. Yeah. He is extradited from Pakistan by a joint FBI/ISI operation.
Yeah.
So this is when Pakistan is feeling cooperative. And during interrogation, it's realized, I think he's interrogated in New York by the FBI, and they come across a business card that he has for this guy, Mohammed Khalifa, who is a relative by marriage to Osama bin Laden. And they press him on it a little bit. They're like, what do you know about this guy? Do you know this guy? And then he shuts up.
Yeah.
So we don't really know, right? But anyway, the CIA is like collecting intel, and OBL's name keeps popping up. Hearing about this guy. At the same time, 1993, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama's kind of like right hand, he starts speaking at like mosques in California. And there's this other, like, I don't remember his name, but there's a CIA contact who starts warning the CIA about Al-Qaeda in Sudan specifically. He's like, you guys got to look out for these guys. They, well, you trained them, so they've got pretty good training, wouldn't you say, right? And they've also got money, and they're also very devoted to this cause. So take note.
They seem pretty serious.
They're pretty into it, you know?
They're pretty into it. Like, it's not like a, it's not like a, it's not like a fad.
It's not a phase, Mom. Yeah.
It's that.
They're all about it, Then, later that year, in October of 1993, two U.S. helicopters are downed in Somalia. And they had been assisting the U.N. as they attempted to relieve a famine. So this is kind of like post-Persian Gulf at this point. And the U.S. is like, what else can we do to help out internationally? And so they're like, we can assist the U.N. in Somalia. And there's like a Somalian clan war is going on. Yeah. It's not it's framed not quite as a civil war, more of like a clan war, but I don't know when that threshold is crossed. So these two helicopters go down, and Osama takes credit for it, but that's kind of dubious from what the books are telling me. Is it's like they had made contacts, and he sent like he sent a couple Al-Qaeda guys to Somalia while this was going on, and they were not received well. So it's kind of, but regardless, U.S. troops are like dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, and so Clinton orders the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Somalia.
I mean, I don't think that they were like technically in Somalia, probably for like, I mean, they were in Somalia for the U.N. mission, but it's also, Somalia is also the strategic, right on the
I see what you're saying. I didn't even think about that.
The Red Sea, so like they, because that's we help places that are specific,
that are geographically important.
We'll help some more aid. We'll send.
Of
some
course,
aid.
We will. It's our Christian duty to do so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Osama had been, or he had bought an American T-39. And he was using that plane to smuggle Stinger missile launchers just for wherever he thought they needed, were needed. You know, he's just kind of spreading the love, you know?
That is, I guess. When you hear your homeboy have that, like he has that plan, you're like, all right, you going to jail, man.
Yeah, like, man, this cannot end well.
I'm done with this. This is when you get up and just leave.
I'm in too deep, man. At this point, you're flying Stingers around the middle. Stinger missile. You're flying CIA, not CIA made, but CIA, not manufactured, not produced, distributed. See, CIA weapons are just, you're just, what are you doing?
Yeah, fam, I like the chili relleno here, but I don't need it like that.
So no, man.
I'm going to get my stuff to go from now on.
Yeah,
all, this whole situation is hot. Everybody about to go to jail over here.
Yeah, you guys are gonna get inspected or something. The hammer of justice is gonna come down because you can't just do this. But apparently you can. So I don't know,
no,
man.
You can.
Everything's so much more fragile than we pretended.
Oh yeah, no. It's the
when world. You have dudes who are just like, yeah, I'm gonna fucking fly my stingers around, bro. I shoot this thing for fun. All right, yeah. You know, you don't get a rush quite like you do when you're shooting a CIA distributed Stinger missile launcher and a helicopter, right?
What do you need? A Stinger? Check outside.
Check outside.
Check outside your door.
Also need an Azerbaijani bike? I've got a bunch of those if you want.
How are we going to put the Stinger missiles on the bikes? That's the thing. Actually, you can think about that. That's where the real money is. Putting
that
the
is
Stinger
Al-Qaeda's mounted artillery, right? That's what it is.
That's where it's at. And people don't talk about that. Because they're idiots.
Because
they're dumb. And they're not. They don't know what is as a money jack bikes are. All
right,
move on.
Not where the real game's at, right?
They don't know.
February of 1944, Bin Laden survives an assassination attempt. I didn't look, or there wasn't that much information on it. It was a group of Libyans under this guy Mohammed Abdullah al-Khilafi, and it was weird because the way it was described, they were just like kind of just looking for him. Like first they I think they shot up a mosque where he was known to speak.
Yeah.
And then they shot up like a police. They shot up a police station, got weapons, then shot up the mosque, then shot up some other place, then like drove to the street where his home was known to be at and like shot that up as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know why or but that's the link, is look up al-Khilafi and see what he's into. And I don't know, it could be Gaddafi for all we know. They're Libyans, right?
I mean, are they like into like, are they like Islamists or anything?
I think so. I don't.
Yeah, he didn't fuck with them. He didn't fuck, like when it becomes like more like jihadi type stuff. Mm. That's when Gaddafi is all of a sudden. Like, I don't fuck with none of that.
Yeah, that's what I don't. And then also he had that, he was very, he was pretty territorial. Like he was the big dog in North Africa. And all of a sudden, this other guy is going to come over here. That's my spot, man.
Yeah.
You're in my corner, you know?
Yeah, him fighting in Chad in the Toyota War, what they call Toyota War, because it just featured people driving around Toyota pickup trucks and AK-47s shooting at each other.
You never see that car commercial. Part of Chad. That's what I'm disappointed about,
what?
You know?
You don't see
See that car commercial.
Yeah. That's
what I'm disappointed about, you know?
You could do anything in a Toyota.
Chevy. Watch this. That'd be horrible. Chevy, you know, whatever. Whatever slogan they have. Ride tough. And then the car explodes. Anyway.
Jesus. Okay.
Around.
Yeah, you know what I mean, the Chevrolet, they built Taliban tough. All right.
Built to last, you know.
Built to last. All right.
And then it blows up, and then you think it's not there anymore, but it turns out it is, right? It survived that because it's built to last, right? He begins speaking out against the Saudi royal family right around this time. So his family visits. And they encourage him to try to reconcile with the Saudi royal family, and Osama bin Laden refuses. In March, he has his citizenship revoked by al-Saud, and al-Saud is kind of nudged by the Egyptian government because the Egyptian government were upset over Ayman al-Zawahiri's raids into Egypt, because that's also going on, and they're kind of unable to distinguish between al-Jihad, which is Zawahiri's organization, and al-Qaeda, which is the broader organization. I think it's safe to say, I don't know how distinct al-Jihad was from al-Qaeda. I really don't know. I mean, it seems like al-Qaeda is al-Jihad seems to be made up of primarily Egyptians, and then al-Qaeda is more international. So that's what I can suppose.
Okay.
The same year, you see the rise of the Taliban in 1994. Taliban means the Students of Islam. And they first come to prominence around Kandahar, and they kind of frame their coming to power as a populist uprising. Like, there was this guy in the 18th century, I believe, who united a bunch of the tribes, and he was also from Kandahar, or he was active around Kandahar, and so they're trying to, like, harken back to that, to the good old days or whatever.
Yeah.
And the one of the central players in the Taliban is this guy, Mullah Mohammed Omar, whom they call the Blind Sheikh because he was blind.
Yeah. There's a lot of blind dudes, dude.
Yeah.
Sheikh bin Baz.
Blind?
There's like, yeah, blind, dude. Blind, still. Yeah, a lot of blind dudes.
You get that higher sight, man, you know?
Yeah.
Supposedly. Yeah,
all the rest of your mm-hmm. senses, now they're heightened.
And you're left to kind of stir in the blackness of your own mind.
Oh, God damn, that was depressing. All right.
Well, it depends on what you fill your mind with, I guess. October and November of 1994, Benazir Bhutto, who is the president of Pakistan, is trying to carve out a more international role for Pakistan. She wants to specifically like revive its kind of Silk Road status, so she's also like harkening back to older traditions. And they want to build like inroads into Central Asia. But I don't know how our listeners' geography is. There's something in between Central Asia and Pakistan, and that is Afghanistan. And so Pakistani convoys roll through Afghanistan and they start distributing weapons and money to the Taliban, who then take the Kandahari airport from Massoud's forces. There was like one of Massoud's deputies had control of Kandahar, not anymore. Taliban take Kandahar.
That's the important thing about Afghanistan is not anything inside of Afghanistan. It is what Afghanistan touches.
Yeah.
What you can get through Afghanistan. I mean, there's some good minerals.
Yeah.
There's some good minerals, but it's a lot about, people care about what it touches. A
lot of geopolitics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they also have to, Pakistan also has to be careful because they're also supposedly trying to prop up Hekmatyar, and he's got control over all these like border madrasas, kind of located around Peshawar and across the border and everything. And they wanted to use those to train insurgents to fight in Kashmir, which again is that like hotly disputed little slice of land that Pakistan and India both have claimed to. I think it's like right in the corner of the Himalayas. So there's a lot going on. Yeah, Pakistan is playing the game, you know?
It's the reason why the Kashmir is so like important is because like it's like the main river that like goes through that like it basically like you can control the water supply of like Pakistan.
Wow.
Like if you basically dam up.
Yeah.
Like the river that, so like that's why they know that. Both of them know that. So it's like well, we want this.
Or you could cut off the water supply entirely. Yeah. If you were so inclined.
oh, dam it up and then like let it trickle out and then kind of control the power.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's crazy.
Like a hugely a territory so small would be so hugely consequential. August of 1995, this is Osama bin Laden's Frank Manifesto, and he starts publicly declaring his hatred of the U.S. He starts issuing all these fatwas against the U.S. He decries al-Saud and the Saudi royal family for the presence of U.S. forces in the Holy Land and all the base deals that have been going on between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. And then the very next month, September of 95, the Taliban takes Herat, meaning they effectively control southern Afghanistan, and they declare their intention to march on Kabul. At this point, it's fairly well known that Pakistan is supplying them. It had only been like 9 or 10 months, but it's not a well-kept secret at this point.
Yeah.
95 to 96, this is when Saudi Arabia increases its support of the Taliban, and it's initially humanitarian, kind of providing them with like Qurans, food and medicine, and also money funneled through charities. The Saudi Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice helps the Taliban build up their own internal police force in accordance with the tenets of Islam. And at this point, it becomes pretty clear that both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are going to leverage the Taliban over Hekmatyar. Like, Hekmatyar is not the favorite anymore as far as these two nations are concerned. They've now, it seems, switched over to supporting the Taliban. And, you know, meanwhile, Pakistan is also publicly denying its role to the U.S. And the U.S. is like, hey, are you funding these guys? Pakistan is like, what? No, of course not. Meanwhile, they're doing exactly that. So on June 26th of 1995, the what is then known as the Organization of African Unity, now just known as the African Union, they have a meeting in Ethiopia. There's the attempted assassination of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak at the airport in Addis Ababa.
Mubarak.
Hosni Mubarak at the airport in Addis Ababa by al-Jihad / Zawahiri, because again, this is kind of his organization. Yeah. It fails, however, in the investigation. Sudanese intelligence is implicated. And so now it's like, oh shit, Sudan, you guys are working with these guys? Really? You guys are trying to take me out? What's going on? We have an issue, right?
Yeah. It's weird to, like, I don't think about these parts of the world as the place that, like, Al-Qaeda was starting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe Egypt, but, like, I don't think about the Sudan and Ethiopia, and, you know, soon we'll get to, you know, Kenya. Like, all these places that were like, oh, this is like where it was originally, like, they were, like, building up their first, you know, big, what's it called? Big franchises, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Building the brand, right?
Yeah, yeah.
January of 1996, ALEC is founded. And this is like an interdepartmental intelligence office at the fifth floor of the CIA. They had tapped Osama bin Laden's phone and were monitoring his international conversations as a means of tracking his money. And I don't think they say specifically on their like foundation documents that it's like, you know, they just keep it broad and they're like, we're here to take down terrorism. But really, they're just like, they're looking at Osama from jump. And he's like their main guy that they're looking at.
That's the funny thing about like when the FBI or the CIA gets onto you, they get onto you so early.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're onto you like it's always like, I always hear about like rappers getting like going to jail. Like for crimes and stuff. It's like they had them 7 years ago.
Yeah.
If it's the FBI, they have you 7 years ago.
Yeah.
They're just waiting
until
the perfect moment.
Until you really fuck up. And then they're like, yeah, boom, we got you.
Or until you get successful. It's like, all right, well, that's enough of that. Mm-hmm. Like,
but also like how they're tracking his money. You know, they're hitting him where it hurts. Like, let's just watch the wires tick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that dude's putting Stinger missiles on bikes. Good job, dog.
He's crazy.
You're going to get CIA attention.
Yeah, man. You can't just do that, all right? Spring of 1996, Timothy Carney, who is the U.S. ambassador to Sudan, he talks with Sudanese President Ali Osman Taha about the U.S.'s decision to close its embassy in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Taha is upset because he felt that he had actually taken steps to curb radicalism, and he doesn't want Sudan to look bad internationally, and so he's like, what can we do? And Carney says if the Sudanese government could maybe give them the names of Mujahideen who were known to be in the area, maybe you could hand over Osama bin Laden. That would certainly help, right? And then we could talk about things, right? And Sudan says that they would comply if the U.S. had a solid case against him, and at this point, they really don't. Like, the U.S. is asking Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia if they had a case, perhaps, if they would take Osama, or maybe if they were not even had a case, if they were just willing to take Osama bin Laden into custody without a case, but like, they also don't really have, they don't have a case, and they're not willing to take him in without. Like, he hasn't done anything super wrong yet that we can definitively say this was you, right? So it's all like in this legally ambiguous territory.
Damn, look at that pre 9/11 justice.
Mm-hmm.
Where you needed an actual case
when the system worked, right?
Bro, you know? We went from that to like now we're like droning kids because they Skyped the wrong nigga.
Yeah, it's bad.
The metadata.
It'll get you, man. Metadata will get you. This gets us into Act 2, Exodus. In May of 1996, pressured by the Sudanese, Osama bin Laden liquidates his assets and relocates his family to Jalalabad in Afghanistan. Many of his men do not follow him because the money's kind of drying up. And so he's kind of left with more or less his core, if you want to think, or just like maybe the dudes who just didn't have anything else fucking going on. So they just, I don't know if you think of them as core, like they're the most devoted, or it's just like, I don't have any other life goals. You know, this is kind of, it's kind of what I'm doing, right?
Nah, man, you're in a startup and you've attached yourself to the founder and you really don't have any like real business ideas yourself, but the founder seems to keep having a new idea, and you've already believed he got pretty close last time. Got pretty close last time to his startup idea. So
he knows where he's going, and it's just like, you know what? Sometimes it's not always sunk cost fallacy. You know, maybe we'll really hit something. Around this time, he also
Osama bin Laden, the Steve Jobs of terrorism. All right, sorry.
Okay. Around this time, OBL begins to view America as public enemy number one. And there's a tentative alliance going on around this time between Hekmatyar and Massoud. However, Massoud is kind of wary of Hekmatyar. Hekmatyar encourages Massoud to leave Kabul and attack like to the south and to the east, you know, because they're like pushing back against the Taliban. And then Hekmatyar sells Massoud out, so the Taliban take Kabul. And Massoud goes back into the Panjshir Mountains, which he's so well acquainted with.
It's always the infighting.
Yep.
Yeah, that's like the yeah. All right.
This is like a big, but Hekmatyar is like, I don't know. He just seems like such a little pussy. You know, he's like, here he is, like he was the top dog. You know, he was like, I got the ISI behind me. I got the GID behind me. And then here comes the Taliban, and immediately both of those organizations, both those nations broadly, like fall out of love with Hekmatyar. They're like, nah, we're with the Taliban now. And then Hekmatyar's like, oh, me too, you know? Like, I don't know, maybe he was angling, maybe he was trying to eliminate his primary rival so he could, but at this point it's like, nah, man, your 15 minutes are over, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can define Hekmatyar's like decision here by the old Kenny Rogers song. You gotta know when to hold 'em. You gotta know when to fold 'em.
Yep.
And you gotta know when to walk away.
Also,
you never count your blessings.
Never.
While you're sitting at the table. All right, sorry.
Not even for a second. All right. And Hekmatyar, he didn't. I don't know what he did or didn't do. I know he did a lot of bad shit. That's what I do know.
Yeah, I know Hekmatyar. He's an old riverboat gambler.
I think so. I actually think there are probably pretty strict rules, regulations against gambling. Probably it's probably banned.
Well, no, it's a mind state. Being a riverboat gambler is a mind state.
So you can violate religious law in international waters, is what you're saying?
No. Being a riverboat gambler, that's just the type of person. Like, if you have a kid,
you're not necessarily gambling.
One of your kids might pop out, and they're like, you're an old-timey hustler.
I see.
Just like, you just know automatically. They hang the kid upside down.
Yep.
They slap the kid. Like, oh, that kid's.
And he, like, kind of, yeah.
He wiggles a little bit. And yeah. He, like, shows some dice, and he, like, puts a blackie mile in his mouth and talks about Louisville being a good town.
You just know. You know right then. Yep. Isn't life just one big gamble, man?
Oh, my God.
Isn't it all just one big gamble, bro? Huh? Right?
I gotta.
We're all gamblers.
Yeah, get out of Southern Ohio.
Summer of 1996, OBL is issuing more fatwas against the U.S. from his compound. He names it Khorasan, which is after like a large, I think it was a caliphate or like a Islamic empire centered in Afghanistan in 16th or 17th century, I think. And he is issuing these fatwas. Again, same reasons, Israel, U.S. support of Israel, presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. At this point, he declares that there is like a moral obligation to wage jihad against the U.S. And so Alex starts to, you know, this pops up on Alex's radar again, and they fucking make that file on him and are going through it and adding more stuff and collecting intel on him. This is also when around the time when Osama bin Laden meets with this guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He's a globetrotting radical, the uncle of Ramzi Youssef, the initial bomber of the World Trade Center. He's talking about his nephew, and he's bragging on his nephew because, again, Youssef was like a little tinkerer. And he's saying that there's a way Youssef discovered that he could like make bombs out of small nitroglycerin devices. So they start plotting together. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed passes off his schemes to Osama bin Laden, one of which involves hijacking planes and flying them into buildings. So they start nesting that egg, you know?
Yeah, that's just a wild convo.
it really is, isn't it?
My man is over here. His wife is bringing out cookies and coffee and shit,
mm-hmm.
and a little shortbread. And this and this dude's over here talking about, yeah, I can fly a plane into a building.
I think there's a way we could really do it, man. I think there's a way we could really figure this out, and it would be.
that makes Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Silicon Valley in the startup world. Uh-huh. That's just like that like old hippie-ish dude that's been he had a role in like Apple.
Yeah,
he was at Google when it like first started.
He remembers taking apart his Atari and rebuilding it. You know?
And he has like all these fucking crazy ideas. Like he has money because he's just around, but these fucking crazy ideas that like really you should never do.
You shouldn't do. They're bad ideas. But he meets his young startup guy, and something clicks.
It's just the story about startups.
Yep.
This is a social network.
It's
more explosions.
More explosions, more deaths, more horror, more big questions of why, you know?
I don't know, big dog. Facebook has caused a lot of those things.
You know, you are right. You are not wrong on that count. That is true. February of 1997, Gary Schroen, Gary Schroen is like the guy in Afghanistan in the late 80s, and he's still in the Far East Division, I'm pretty sure. I think he's still with the CIA. I'm not sure in which capacity he's functioning at this point, but it's higher than just a field agent who's out there. You know, he's moved up.
He's a wheeler and a dealer, sorry.
He meets with the governor of Kandahar, who is a Taliban guy at this point. He details the Stinger buyback program, because we're still doing that, right? You're still pushing that. You know, like, hey, you got those Stingers, bro? We'll give you some money for those. Those have gone up in value, as a matter of fact. If you're just and the Taliban's basically like, I think we're gonna keep them.
Yeah,
I think we're gonna keep them.
Let me get those back, big dog. Let me get that. You remember when I loaned you that dangerous weapon? Let me get that back.
I feel
comfortable with it now.
I like it. You know, I feel like. I carved my initials into it, and I carved a little sigil into it. I got notches on this, bro. I got notches. You want this? This is used equipment, right?
Most people, they're Toyota guys, they're Ford guys. Not me. I'm a Stinger, on top of an Azerbaijani bike.
That's what really speaks to me. You know, that's I would have loved it if he would have like quoted back to him whatever like Robert Taft said about Lend-Lease, and was like, what is it that Robert Taft said about Lend-Lease? He was like, getting back war equipment is like getting back chewing gum. You don't really want it back. If he just like knew that and was just like, no. Sherwin's like, I don't really know how to argue with that. I did not expect that throwback when I went to have this conversation, you know?
That's
probably not how it went, but one can imagine. Right?
The guy who wrote West Wing, Aaron Sorkin. That's how in a show that he would make about that the conversation.
Yeah,
that's the exact line.
That's how it would go. That's how it
would
go.
Would say to the CIA agent, he would reference of Robert.
I need to write for Aaron Sorkin. All right, let's make this happen.
I mean, all right, Doc. Aaron Sorkin is known as being extremely pretentious.
That's fine, bro. You know who you're talking to? I feel like. So they turned back the. They said that they're keeping him to fight Iran nominally, which is just something they throw out, which is like, okay.
No, I'd be dope.
During this conversation, they also, the Taliban offers Gary Schroen, if they offer to export OBL back to Saudi Arabia, and Schroen turns him down because I believe that, I think, again, they don't really have a case on this guy, but it at least goes to show that there are tensions between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, specifically Osama bin Laden, right? And he's, at this time, Osama bin Laden is in Kandahar, like, delivering sermons and funding public works. He has a lot of land again. I think one of the names of his domiciles, his farm, it's the Tarnak Farms, I believe is the name of one of them. So Masood, he starts receiving support from India, Russia, and Iran. And Masood is still engaging in talks with Schroen, who wants to enlist him in the fight against Osama specifically. But Masood is like, yeah, I'm down to help. But also, are you really going to let the Taliban come to power? They are also very dangerous. And what's interesting about those three countries with like... Yes. Russia, India, and Iran is that India's mad at Pakistan and they're supporting the Taliban, but they're specifically beefing over Kashmir. Russia is upset at anybody using the border madrasas because some of the people, some of the Mujahideen being trained at those border camps are ending up in Chechnya. So it's all related. And then Iran and Afghanistan just have that classic. Or they're Shia and Sunni, are they? Are they not? Or is that part of the division?
I don't know. I don't know the makeup of Afghanistan, but I also do know. I think we talked about this before. There's a lot of heroin.
Yeah, I see.
They have a big heroin problem, and maybe I don't know. Maybe that's part of their issue, but I have no clue. I know that Iran and Afghanistan don't fuck with each other, and I just don't know the basis for it. Other than that heroin thing, but it might not be it.
I mean, that's it's a pretty good reason, you know. You're kind of poisoning the veins of our people, and we're not really about it.
Nah, in the U.S., we would call you a corporation. That's what we.
right.
Boom.
Fall of 1997, Madison Albright and Hillary Clinton start speaking out against how the Taliban is treating women, and they're citing all of these civil rights violations, and they're coming increasingly at odds with this guy, Marty Miller. Mm-hmm. You know Marty Miller, right? He's a top executive of Unocal, and he is lobbying for a pipeline that would run through Afghanistan and connect Central Asia to Pakistan. He had some contacts within Clinton's cabinet. Robin Raphael, who's Assistant Secretary of State for Southeast Asia and responsible for policy toward Afghanistan specifically, and Sheila Heslin, who is on Clinton's National Security Council. And their whole idea is they need a customer for this pipeline if they're going to build it. So they need Pakistan to agree to buy the oil, which I'm pretty sure they would in order to get some international aid dollars. And they're saying like it could unite the country if, you know, you build the nation around this pipeline is their basic idea. And so again, in 1997, he goes as far as to invite members of the Taliban over to his house in Sugar Land, none other than Sugar Land, to talk about it. And there's an article that describes him. Like him and his wife, before these guys from the Taliban come over, they had some garden statues of like Indonesian vases, Indonesian like statues that they had got from I think they were like Hindu or something. Either way, in the eyes of the Taliban, they were idolatrous, and so they needed to be covered before these guys came to dinner. Sugar Land.
Yeah, that is just like Sugar Land. That is like...
Yeah, that's pretty standard Sugar Land, I think.
No, that's my favorite thing about like the suburbs of Houston. It's like, you know how many like weird, shady like oil deals have like gone on like around here? Like,
This is where my uncle lives in Sugar Land, and he made a bunch of money in oil.
Yeah.
Although it's not Unocal. So
like why
he's good like, as far why, as I know.
Like why was MBS like building homes in like Aldine? Like and that was like a thing. Like he there was like a that was like his on his public little tour before like he killed Jamal Khashoggi. Like
that's crazy. He's,
like I know when I go to the Taste of Texas in fucking in Memorial, it's all the goddamn steaks over there, dog. And I'm like, dude, somebody. Whew, there was some.
You know who didn't have to wait for a table at Taste of Texas?
Yeah.
MBS.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably no. He just got seated right away. Look,
some, yeah. some country got there was the a coup was planned at Taste of Texas on I-10. I promise you. I promise you. Man. I promise you. This is wild.
February 23rd of 1998. Bin Laden announces the International Islamic Front for Jihad against Jews and Crusaders, and it's signed by a lot of different, a lot of top operatives of a lot of different groups, and again, doubles down, like, it is your moral imperative to just go out and kill Jewish people and Christians, and that's how you serve God, so let's do it, right? And
sick.
A lot of other organizations kind of under his umbrella, like specifically Al-Jihad is mentioned in Zawahiri, they don't necessarily want to be global, you know? They kind of, they want to pursue their own national aims, which in Al-Jihad's case is Egypt. But that's another thing that's kind of behind all of this that the CIA is discovering is that, like, the face of terrorism has changed. It's more international in scope, and you're not talking about nations. You're talking about people unified by ideology, and that's much different.
Yeah, yeah.
Than what we've known. Spring of 1998. There's a CIA plan known as.
So what you're saying is, he is now the Facebook of terrorism. I just want to keep hammering. The startup of terrorism needle thread throughout this entire thing. So
it's coming through.
Yeah, it's gonna. I will keep pushing it. He's the Facebook.
Can you imagine if we lived to see the day, or if Osama lived to see the day when, like, Twitter? You know how many Twitter followers he might have.
I would be constantly asking them, like, if. I'd be checking that Twitter just to be like,
yeah, I would look at
who's he targeting. Where's he at?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what's he saying? I want to check in on this little dark corner of the web.
Just keep an eye on it.
Yeah, you know, he could probably make some money doing it. Anyway, there's the spring 1998 TrodPint, which is a CIA plan to capture bin Laden from his bed. And they're like using. And they're arming these Afghani contacts in order to arrest him. They were going to detain him for 30 days inside of a well-provisioned cave while a legal team found a case to indict him under so he could be extradited to the U.S. Because, again, they're still dealing within the framework of the system. They're like, all right, this guy's a problem, and we need to take care of him, and we have our eyes on him, and we're trying to figure it out, but... He hasn't done anything yet that we can we have no pretext quite yet, right?
Again, that is not how it works anymore.
No, it's much different. It's much different today. I wonder why, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, bin Laden is traveling around Afghanistan, and like I previously mentioned, some of Al-Qaeda and some of the border madrasas are still operational, and these trainees are in two of the places that they go are Kashmir and Chechnya. And I just thought that it was interesting that we've talked about both of these things on the show in prior episodes, but it's all related. Mm-hmm, it's all connected, you know.
International society is good and the bad with that big dog.
yep, for sure. Mid-June of 1998, Prince Turki and his entourage arrive in Afghanistan to talk with Mullah Omar, the blind sheikh, one of the top guys in Taliban, if not the. Prince Turki basically tried to turn him against bin Laden, and again, who had been like issuing fatwas and leveling threats against the Saudi royal family. Mullah Omar points out that the Pashtun or the Pashto tribal code has restrictions against betraying guests. And with Prince Turki from Saudi Arabia, there's like this Saudi Arabian sheikh, or he might have been a member of the Ulema. Either way, he's like a religious scholar, and he's going toe-to-toe with Mullah Omar.
Yeah.
He points out that Mullah Omar's guest, Osama bin Laden, had broken his word by granting press interviews. Mm-hmm. So do you necessarily need to uphold that provision of the tribal code if he's not holding up his end? Does that then nullify his protection? Maybe you can extradite him. And they're kind of going back and forth. It doesn't end up happening.
Yeah, I wonder if that was Sheikh bin Baz. And, like, it's just interesting because I've seen, like, doing Saudi Arabia in, like, this episode, you're seeing that, like, in this society, there's, like, this, third say. It's always, like, a third that, like, they, like, defer to, like, Islamic law so much.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the real player in terms of, like, what they feel like they can and can't do and, like, a real thing that they have to actually move around and operate around. It's very interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting, where they actually believe it, unlike us in the West, I suppose. I mean, I don't believe, but I'm just saying.
Speak for yourself, big dog.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. July of 1998, the CIA operatives kidnap Ahmed Salama Mabrouk outside a restaurant in Azerbaijan. They also clone his laptop computer, which is like they have a full roster of Al-Qaeda members at this point. And for a while, the CIA refuses to turn it over to the FBI. And this gets into kind of the very competitive nature of intelligence agencies. They jealously guarded their intelligence because it was not only about, like, you would think it would be first and foremost they want to catch the bad guys, but they also want to catch a sweet taste of that glory.
Yeah.
And more specifically, catch some of those appropriations.
Yeah.
And if their department is doing more of the footwork, if their department is getting more results, then of course they're going to get more funding. They're going to get more shiny stinger missiles, right?
I'm not too sure about this, but it's more my thought to be like, yeah, it's also after the Cold War has ended, so people are looking at the military and looking at these institutions that we set up and being like, how necessary are y'all? Like,
yeah, because what are you guys really doing? I see.
And that's so, in that kind of climate, maybe I'm guessing that, you know.
They have to prove their necessity and prove that they are a public good, but not the whole thing, just our branch specifically.
Yeah.
Because this
is our department and we do this specific thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also like, so like the CIA just a lot, it seems a lot less valid of a thing because, you know, the Cold War, but, you know.
Yeah.
They find a new thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it's like a different type of tribalism almost.
Tribalism is everywhere, big dog.
Yeah, it's true. This gets us into Act 3, Retribution. August 7th. Of 1998, two teams of suicide bombers roll into two African capitals. They attack the American embassy at both Nairobi in Kenya and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. There are 213 dead with 4,500 wounded in Nairobi and 11 dead with 85 wounded in Tanzania. Here's the weird thing is, like, in July of 1998, Prince Turkey had been talking with the Taliban about the extradition again of Osama bin Laden. And it was like, do you really want this guy here? And these conversations were taking place, and it's posited by Steve Cole, or he's just asking the question, like, did Mullah Omar, if he went as far as to protect this guy, did he know that this was about to happen?
Yeah.
And if he did, would this have changed his mind about harboring this fugitive, or would he have agreed to cooperate and extradite? I'm not entirely sure. As far as like the bomb, the attacks themselves, that was a Al Qaeda sleeper cell that was kind of a remnant of Osama's time in Sudan. Some of the names associated with it as Hage.
Wahaj.
KK Mohammed.
Wadi al Haj, but that might.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. KK Mohammed is another guy. Wadi al Haj actually also ends up, I believe, living in Texas.
Okay.
So this is very Texas, very Texas story today, really.
Yeah.
We got three. We got one more coming around the bend, you know?
Yeah.
And this gets international fame for Osama bin Laden. So now, if ever, if they had a case or if they needed a case, they probably have one now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one would hope. So on August 8th of 1998, very next day, the CIA receives intel that Osama and his top dogs were meeting at this place, Zawahiri, on the 20th of that month. Which Zawahiri is 7 miles south of coast, so still kind of on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they authorize airstrikes against him. Before this takes place, August 17th, the Monica Lewinsky story breaks. And so now everything that Clinton does is operating in under this giant, pervasive media cloud. So on the 20th, 1998, at this meeting at Zawahiri, the compound is assaulted by 75 Tomahawk missiles, killing 21 Pakistani jihadists, but no bin Laden. This is part of Operation Infinite Reach.
Yeah.
I think they attack multiple targets as well. I think they hit a place in Khartoum that they thought was manufactured, or they thought was like for enriching uranium, but it turns out to be just a medical facility. I think they hit some other targets too, but I'm not sure. It's largely considered a failure. It kind of highlighted the lack of communication between the different apartments, because at this point you're dealing with like the NSC, and not yet the NSA, but like the National Security Council, the CIA, and the FBI are all kind of operating on their own frequencies and not communicating with each other as well as they should. The CIA is on high alert, and they're like surging with intel and passing a lot of perhaps too much unfiltered intelligence to Clinton. And there are like executive papers outlining exactly what the CIA could or could not do to apprehend or even kill bin Laden. There was an executive order banning assassinations, but bin Laden could be considered like a military target. And so maybe there's like a loophole around that. Maybe you can figure something out, and like maybe this executive order doesn't apply. But at this point, it's like a very sophisticated form of bureaucratic semantics, with the end result that CIA officers play this conservatively. They don't want to overstep because everybody is afraid of public outrage or being caught being caught generally. More than this, Attorney General Janet Reno, she had approved lethal force against bin Laden at this point, but only if an attack was imminent. And so the question is then asked, what's the time frame on imminent? How do you specifically define imminent or imminency? How do we figure?
I don't.
What do you think?
Yeah, because it's like hard to be like, oh, what, something could have changed? It seems like he was pretty dead set on getting this one off. He seemed pretty.
Yeah,
dead.
He's gonna do. So. He's escalating.
Yeah,
you know,
like this is right. Yes, I can tell. Like we both grew up during the time of school shootings. Because we're like, yeah, no, he's escalating. He's ramping towards something.
Like, yeah, he's clearly behaving in a way that, like, he had that freak out in shop class. Yeah. And I don't know, man. I'm kind of.
Yeah, dude, he's kind of.
I think I'm going to start skipping shop.
Yeah, now he's on Facebook talking about he's going to kill people. And also, he wears jean shorts. So.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, cut off jean shorts.
Yeah.
He makes them himself with scissors.
Yeah.
It's disturbing, frankly. All right.
Yeah.
And he's just got such skinny little calves. They're not only skinny little chicken legs, they're also hairy.
My man.
And it's very gross.
My man is pale. He is pale.
Very. Incredibly.
Ever.
Pale, hairy chicken legs in jean shorts.
In a hoodie.
It's like, if you're so cold, why are you wearing jean shorts?
Yeah.
You make no sense,
all
right?
He'd just be saying weird shit like, my top half cold. I'm like, yeah.
Okay. All right, dude. Always sniffling. Angry. Always sniffling.
Just an angry kid. This kid is probably the nicest kid.
Maybe, yeah.
But he, yeah. Okay.
Late 1998, DCI of the CIA, George Tenet, he writes a memo to other top CIA officials regarding bin Laden, where he says, "We are at war. I want no resources of people spared in this effort." And newspapers, like American newspapers, disclose the media generally had disclosed. I don't know actually if it's, I think it is specifically mentioned newspapers. Sorry. Let me not, the media, let me not do that. Okay. Newspapers disclose they had tapped and tracked Osama bin Laden's cell phone. And so he stops using it because he's able to read that headline. He's like, oh, okay. I didn't like this fucking phone anyway. He snaps it.
That's it. I mean, I always like, yeah, I threw away my phone. Now they can't track me. Uh-huh. They're just going to get you on a new phone. That's what they're going to do.
If you get a new phone, you go phoneless, man. You about that?
Wow. What
you think you
world.
Could?
What a different world. Not today.
Not yet. You know, one day, I imagine one day. Yeah, it would feel
like,
good.
Yeah, you're like that's the same day you're going to fly fish.
It's the same day I'm going to wear sandals regularly.
You already do that. You know? You already do that.
No, man, I'm horrified of my feet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
but I just need to let go.
As you should be. Keep them locked up.
I try, man. They just fucking stink.
Keep those bad boys locked up. You know what I mean?
February of 1999, US has pretty good intel about OBL's whereabouts. He's on a falcon hunting trip in southeast Afghanistan, I believe in Helmand province, for the Hubara Bustard. I guess it's specific to Afghanistan, and like falcon hunting is also something that has occurred since like ancient times in like the steppes, which is kind of cool. And there's a bunch of like wealthy UAE sheikhs with him. And there's a CIA station in Islamabad is talking to Langley, and Gary Schroen himself says, let's just blow the whole thing up.
Yeah, they're not going to do it. I mean,
let's just handle business.
Yeah, again.
Right? Here he is. We got good intel. Let's do it, man.
Again, they didn't do it, but.
They didn't.
But.
They didn't do it.
But this is pre 9/11. This is pre 9/11.
Exactly.
Post 9/11, they would have done that anytime, anybody.
Mm-hmm. For sure. There's a bigger problem, is that in May of 98, there had been a deal, in part negotiated by Richard Clark, who I believe headed or led for a time the national coordinator. His official title for a time was the national coordinator for counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. He was in the State Department. In this deal, the UAE had agreed to buy 80 F-16 military jets for $8 billion over a few years, manufactured in nowhere else but the Lone Star State, great state of Texas itself. And so it's a no-go, because it's also like, we don't want UAE to call off the deal. We don't want Texas to lose these jobs and have to lay off these plant workers who are just going to... I don't know what they would do. I don't know what like laid off plant workers in rural Texas did before be radicalized. You know, I don't know what the pre-internet age was like. I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. It wasn't. I mean, 99 was not that long ago, because I was, you know, like I was alive in 99. So
yeah.
So fuck you. First of all, second of all.
No, I'm just saying. Like my memories of that time are too blurry to. Or I haven't read enough, or I don't know what.
Yeah, I
don't know
what these people would do. 99. Yeah, these people they are 98.
Go outside.
They got off work, they drank a beer, and then watched King of Queens. Or maybe at this time,
that's
a good show. You fuck off.
No, I do enjoy the show, but my man Patton Oswalt in that bad.
Oh yeah, I thought you were gonna shit on King of Queens. I was like, fam.
Of course not.
What is going on, fam? Yeah,
we got problems. That and Home Improvement.
I'm not a big Home Improvement fan.
I'm not either. George Lopez show. I think that was swinging in '99. You know?
George Lopez. I do mess with the George Lopez show, but like it was one on my lap. You know, let's not talk about this.
Okay, right on. So, closing it out, June 24th of 1999, before a Senate hearing, Tenet explains that they have intel that Osama bin Laden is planning an attack on U.S. soil. And, again, he's telling the Senate at this point. They need to be on alert.
Yeah.
So, OBL, he finally makes the FBI's most wanted list. The CIA and the State Department begin reaching out to neighboring nations in search of potential allies. There's this guy, Islam Karimov, who is amenable, and he is an ex-communist autocrat in, where is he? I think he's in Uzbekistan. And Osama bin Laden had been funding jihadists against Karimov. So Karimov is open to launching an operation using like Uzbeks to capture Osama bin Laden. And see this around the same time, CIA authorizes Jawbreaker 5. And they're going to train and supply Massoud's guys, offer him more cash, more secure communications, whatever kind of equipment he needs, listening devices, and non-lethal spy gear. Massoud meets with a State Department official, this guy Rick Inderfirth, in October or November of 1999, and Clinton kind of ties their hands. They solidify the deal, but Clinton's like, oh, but just keep in mind that you guys can only kill Osama bin Laden in self-defense. Yeah. And Massoud, he thinks that's kind of stupid,
yeah.
And he's trying to communicate to Inderfirth and to the State Department and to Clinton and to America generally that they've got a much larger problem than bin Laden, and that is extremism generally. Like, in this instance, this is not unprecedented, but in the modern era, yes, it is unprecedented. They're fighting a Hydra here. And this message has resonance with many, and for every one that is killed, two more extremists are born. So
yeah, man. We're gonna see how that turns out on the next episode.
On the next episode,
Hard Fried History, Part 3, Osama bin Laden. Come back for the next episode. Thank you guys for listening to this one.
You have to at this point. We haven't talked about it yet. We're not even there.
Yeah, we're 99. We know it. Okay. All right. But
we're getting there.
Thank you guys. We'll see you next time. You can find me, Joshua B. Stokes, on Instagram and Twitter, Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Henry, where can they find you at?
Just Henry E. Price. Henry Price. What's up?
Okay. We love you. We'll see you next time. Oh, also, yeah, I'll be at the Secret Group. Okay, you know where I'm at. I'll be at Eighth Wonder on Sunday. Love you guys. We'll see you next time, okay? Peace.
Peace.